Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast. When Justin Trudeau swept to power in 2015, his wife, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau, was front and center at the victory speech.
Merci, Sophie, pour ta force, pour ta compassion, pour ta grandeur d'âme et pour ta générosité profonde.
Et
And as her then-husband thanked her for her strength and profound generosity, she became one of Canada's most high-profile political spouses since her mother-in-law, Margaret, decades earlier. Before Sophie Gregoire Trudeau ever became the wife of, though, she was well-known as a TV personality in Quebec who advocated for women's issues and mental health. She taught yoga. Now, after a split with her husband, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau is returning to some of those themes in a new book. It's called Closer Together. One of her goals, she says, is to help Canadians become more emotionally literate. Sophie Gregoire Trudeau joins us from our Ottawa studio. Good morning.
Matt, you want to make me cry from the beginning of this interview?
What's it like hearing those people chant your name?
Oh, it's not about the people chanting my name at all. It's about the energy that I remember. It's about serving each other. It's about the fact that what Justin said in there, we could still tell each other. I think that we have so much to learn when it comes to relationships and how, you know, we don't have to slay a relationship in order to restructure it. And we can still be bound by love and respect and having each other's backs and hearts. I think that's what family is, bottom line.
When you talk about slaying a relationship, I mean, that sounds like you're quoting Esther Perel.
I am. I quote her often.
She's for people who don't know, she's a psychotherapist, but she's also a podcaster. And she says that most of us would rather kill a relationship than question or change its structure.
Did you read my book, Matt?
I certainly did. Well, when you think of that, I mean, she's somebody that a lot of people turn to for relationship advice. How much of that applies in your own case?
What do you mean exactly?
Well, I mean, when she talks about many of us would rather kill the relationship rather than question it or change its structure, how much of that applies in your own case?
Well, yeah, it absolutely applies because we are still bound by respect and love and we have each other's backs and minds and hearts. That's what family is. I think that, you know, romantic love is rooted in deep friendship. And sometimes when the relationship restructures itself, it doesn't mean that you have to create that much distance that you don't have that friendship anymore. But it's not easy because not everybody kind of evolves at the same rhythm emotionally, and we have to respect each other's boundaries, and it's a learning progress. And sometimes it gets messy, like, you know, in all family life, and it should be, because it kind of makes us appreciate the better times.
How are you doing in the wake of all of this? You've gone through a lot over the last few months, and it's been very public too.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I think of my life, how I live in my daily life, it is not what people see in the media. And at 49, I have another understanding of, you know, having the world's gaze on your relationship or your partner's work. What I see out there doesn't correspond to what I live in my quotidien, you know, in my household, when I'm running errands, when I'm giving speeches, when I'm meeting people, the love, the support, the understanding that we're all interconnected, that we are all suffering in some way or another. And we have to be very careful to not compare each other's suffering, because really, we're all one trauma away from each other. It takes one traumatic life event to change your mind, the way you perceive yourself and other people, or a series of chronic, you know, smaller traumas to affect in the same way. So I raise my kids, I live not thinking that people who have titles and important position, and I've met so many of them throughout the planet, are more important. I've never believe that. I've never sensed that. The more I grow on the mental health, you know, path, the more I realize that we are so much more the same than we think.
You know, people are going to pick up this book and they're going to be looking for some sort of story about
about
the end of the relationship. And I know, I mean, you've said that you wrote the book and turned it in before all of this happened. But did you, given that, were you tempted to go back and add anything?
You know, at some point you have to let go. And I put so much love and teamwork with all the experts that I interviewed in this book that when the work is done, there's nothing more you can control.
But you know what people, I just, the last point on that is that you know that people will be reading the tea leaves, kind of reading in between lines, looking for something.
So I don't agree with you, Matt. I've met enough humans in my life to know that yes, some will be trying to sniff out the gossip or the whatever. There's not much to sniff out, to be honest. You know, I'm in a family and I'm raising my kids and I've had, you know, a partner where sincerity, open conversations, difficult conversations are at the core of who we are as a family. So even if people dug and dug, there's not much, to be honest. And I feel that this space of calm inside me, most people sense it. And the ones who don't, well, it's okay. I can't control that.
I mentioned in the introduction that before you became known in that role as somebody who was a politician's partner, that you had your own career, you had your own life. How much of that, of your own identity, do you feel you had to give up when you took on the role of Prime Minister's wife?
First of all, I never took on the role of anything. I don't take roles. I am Sophie, who I am. And I think that my friends throughout this whole journey have always seen the same Sophie evolving, I hope, becoming a better person, I hope, as I grow in age and I hope a little bit of more wisdom and life experience. But I've never even seen, you know, my partner in the title or the job that he occupies. I don't define human beings according to what their work is. I accept and sense them and live with them according to how they treat people.
Maybe outside of the work, I mean, just living a very public life where whatever you say, whatever you do is going to be captured. In the book, one of the people that you speak with is Gábor Maté. And he was quoted elsewhere saying that you wanted to be free and not constrained. I just wonder whether you felt constrained in that.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of things here. First of all, freedom comes from within. And the more you grow in age, I think the more you sense this. And because I never defined myself as, you know, the wife of somebody or somebody in a role, doing some type of function, I've never perceived myself that way. And I always remember, Matt, at the beginning, people were asking me, how is it to be the wife of a prime minister? And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm just Sophie G in the house. I'm staying the same person. I don't change personality to adapt to, you know, different situations. I adapt to life, yes, and I try to remain open, but I don't define myself as a human being and as a woman in that way. So when you tell me public life, it's a part of my life, but those couple of events where people see me in high heels because there's protocol and a nice dress, that's not my life. That's just a little percentage where I'm doing, you know, and I respect the protocol that's being put forward. But other than that, that's not what my life looks like.
Early on in your time, in that role, such as it is, there was public outcry when people found out that the government was paying the bill for two nannies to help look after your kids. Your kids mm-hmm. were very young at the time, and there were a lot of different things going on in your life. How do you, when you look back on that now, what goes through your mind?
That there's always a period of adaptation when you step into the political life, especially with young kids. And it's not planned, you know, pre-planned. It's not, there's not a book to follow. So you're just kind of like juggling all the balls and trying to figure out how to keep everybody safe, especially during travels. And I look back and I just think, It was what it was in that moment, and that didn't last for very long.
What did you make of the controversy of it? The fact that people seemed to be outraged that the government, the taxpayers, were paying for help.
Well, that everything is of passage, and that that would pass as well, and that we are good people and we're here to serve, but that in some way, you know, you somebody told me not too long ago, you know, did you develop a thicker skin? I don't think that's me. I don't think my skin is thicker. I think I've been sensing with all of my heart and my and thinking with my mind, but I haven't been taken in kind of the negativity that can come with it, because all of it doesn't belong to me. And so it is important in our own lives, and I talk about this in the book, that when we're surrounded by negativity, choose to bring your attention to nourishment. Choose to put in your body nourishing things and food. Choose to look after yourself when it comes to sleep and what you bring your attention to, because what you where you bring your attention to, energy flows. So I think you have to develop discernment in your own life. And this is what I talk about in this book, that when we live in a society where, you know, self-betrayal is rewarded, when aging is an insult, when we have to change ourselves physically and mentally in order to fit in, that is the opposite of authenticity. And as Dr. Gabor Mate says, we come into this world with the two most basic needs. All humans have these two needs. Attachment, so to be taken care of in the gaze, touch, presence, playfulness, validation of another, how you were kind of cared for by your parent from 0 to 3. And then you bring that wiring in your brain into your teenage years and your adult relationships. Mm. And that child is active your whole life emotionally. And then finally, authenticity. What does it mean to be authentic? It means that you can express your unique character, which is every human being on this planet, without having to adapt or change your behavior in order to please or get love. But Matt, we all do it. We all do it because our inherent need is to feel loved, validated, and seen for who we are. So when you look at the state of the world right now, how many people are overwhelmed, tired, trying to make ends meet, who are losing sleep and having insomnia, who feel depleted and feel that they can't really, they're not empowered themselves to make change in their own family or community or society. As a mental health curious student for 20 years now, I am very concerned. And I've been talking about this for years. And unfortunately, it took a pandemic sometimes for, you know, for people to wake up. And now look where we're at. Mental health issues are the number one cause of absenteeism. That's a hard word to say. Please say it for me. Absenteeism.
As absenteeism?
Thank you. At work.
you trace this back to your own childhood. How would you describe the relationship with your parents when you were growing up?
You know, in my early years, it's difficult sometimes to go back in our early years. If we would ask listeners right now, what are the, you know, sensory memories that you have? Smell, taste, hearing, sight, touch. You know, what do you remember from your childhood? I remember nature because I grew up in nature from like 0 to 4 or 5. I remember going on outings with my father. I remember laughter in my household. I remember being held, being loved. And I also, as I grew up, I also remember feeling like, as an only child, I was at the center of my own parents' dynamics and tensions in their own relationship, and trying to internalize that and save everybody, you know?
You say you wanted to be perfect so that your parents didn't have to worry about you.
Yeah. I think every child kind of has that kind of struggle on some level. And because I was an only child, I internalized it even more. And not to say that people who have brothers and sisters don't live it at that level, not at all. But that was my case, yes. Yep.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
When did you've spoken about this extensively. When did you start to struggle with an eating disorder?
You know what? It's such a tough question, because when you are in the vicious cycle and in the addiction process, you're not starting to count, oh, when did this start? You know, it was in my late teens that I remember. And, you know, eating disorders are the tip of the iceberg. They're like any other kind of addiction compulsion, whether it's sex, whether it's TV watching, whether it's yo-yo dieting, whether it's, going from one relationship to the other. Somehow, mental health is not just about the absence of mental illness. We're all somewhere on that big circle of mental well-being. Mm. So with eating disorders, it stems from a deep emotional longing that is not taking place. And so when we think about trauma, it's not just what was bad that happened to you, and it's also what was good that didn't take place.
Can you just go back to your own experience? There's a story in the book of what happened when you went to Paris with your family.
Yes.
Can you tell us that?
Yeah, so I remember kind of witnessing my own self in a situation where I was going through a purging episode, and I remember feeling so ashamed and feeling like, oh, this is the last time, and feeling like if my parents saw me, oh my God, what would they think? And I kind of like twisted my body around so that my feet would still be facing the front of the stool so that they wouldn't, well, I'm not going to say the whole thing because you have to read the book to understand the context, and I don't want that to be taken out of context. But it was a moment where I witnessed myself in a moment of suffering and, kind of felt sorry for myself in a way from the fact that I was suffering from eating disorders and I wanted it to end. But as with any other compulsion in my late teens, I was kind of stuck in that mode.
When you started to speak out about that, what were you concerned about speaking publicly about going through something like that?
That I'd never be hired again.
That's what you were worried about?
Well, I mean, I was a television and, young television and newcomer on the scene. And I was thinking, okay, I know that it was the right thing to do. I knew that. But I was thinking there might be a price to pay for being that vulnerable and that honest, but I was ready to go for it. So I did it. And it changed the direction of my life path and also my inner compass in a way.
How so?
Because it gave me the reassurance and the bond of trust with other people that when you share your story, when you're being truthful, when you look at people in the eye with sincerity and integrity, people feel it and it allows them to do the same. Rosemarie Charest, the great Quebec psychologist in my book, says that the most unhappy humans that she's met in her life are the ones who cannot trust in others. With Closer Together in this book, I want to expand this circle of trust because people are becoming more and more untrustworthy of each other. And that is not our human nature.
I said in the introduction that you were an advocate for emotional literacy. What does that mean to you?
Emotional literacy is emotional leadership. It means being aware of why we feel the way we do, how we can intervene on our own emotions, and how we can cope better with stress and anxiety, insecurity, and the uncertainty of life.
So if we were, as Canadians, more emotionally literate, what would that look like, do you think?
When we become more of a leader of our own inner world, we move from the alert mode in our body and in our nervous system into a more secure mode. So, when I talked with the expert David Livingstone Smith on dehumanization, he said that hate, fear, dehumanizing the other, and there are so many polarizing forces throughout this world and in our country as well. We cannot be naive. We have to look at them head on. If we go from that alert fear mode into a more relaxed state, we are not as threatened by the difference of the other. And look at our country. The diversity we have here is absolutely fantastic. And everybody makes this country better with their own stories. But we have to continue to share our stories. We have to cherish the diversity of stories instead of being or feeling threatened by the other.
There's also a lot of anger in the country right now.
Yes, and it's understandable. Look at the state of the world. How can people feel that they have a sense of agency when we're facing humanity's greatest crises? you know, from climate change to polarization in society, to, you know, the depth of the abyss between the rich and the poor. And a lot of good people, I tell you this, and I meet them every day, are doing all that they can, sacrifices in their own family, devotion to service, to helping each other to create more justice in this world. And it doesn't have to be through politics. It can be through all other levels of life. And I think that when we start doing, you know, when we start having more peace within our homes, within our own bodies and minds, then it reverberates and it has a ripple effect outwards.
How do you model that as a parent of teenagers?
Good question. You know, if parents are listening right now, I think that whatever you say to your kids are words. How you act towards your own self, how much compassion, patience, empathy, discernment you have over your own life is what they catch on up. You know, they really latch to that energetically and they see it, they sense it. It's not perfect, right? We all mess up. And I think we should also admit are messing up to our kids, that we're not perfect beings. And parenting, and I talk about it in a whole chapter in the book with Dr. Shefali, is a relationship. It's not a role. And if we don't take care of our own egos and our own trauma as parents, well, then we leave a very heavy emotional luggage to our own kids.
But you write in the book about, and we were talking about anger earlier, about seeing some of the anger, and it's not just online, seeing it face to face, that the kids would see signs in car windows saying F Trudeau.
Mm-hmm.
What did you say to them about that?
It makes me sad. It makes me sad that there is so much confusion. It makes me sad to see that people, you know, have so much anger and fear, and that we have been taught in many ways to direct that anger and that fear at one person, and that there are forces out there that are really triggering on that message and really pushing that message.
What do you make of the fact that it's really personal? He was here. The Prime Minister was here just a few weeks ago, and I asked him about this. I said, why don't you think people like you?
It's not personal, Matt. There are greater movements in our society that explain the human behavior right now. And it would be irresponsible to analyze this as a constant personal attack constantly and incessantly. Because as a mental health advocate, I now understand that, you know, people who feel insecure, people who need help, people who become angry, we have to support the feelings of insecurity that are at the basis of that. And if we make people feel more secure, because by the way, on Abraham Maslow's pyramid, at the basis, you know, if you have food on your table and a roof over your head, obviously, you know, it's so important to have those basic needs met. But if safety isn't there, it's game over.
Mm.
And safety is not just the absence of threat, it is the presence of connection.
At a time when people are really angry, do you worry, there's a phrase, toxic positivity, that we ask people to find common ground and compassion for each other. But that's really difficult when, for very basic reasons, people are unhappy with each other. People are struggling, people are really frustrated, they're anxious. Do you worry about that sort of toxic positivity?
I am aware of it as I've read upon it and made myself more educated on the matter. I think that, you know, when I look at life in general and from what I've learned on my own path, is that we don't come into life as human beings with our first inhale and our last exhale to be rosy, happy all the time. No. We come here to be conscious. We come here to become responsibilized of our own individualization process and to become the creative person we're meant to be. So I understand the suffering. I get it. And I want to help as much as I can. And it's only by coming closer together, which is no fluke that I chose that for the title of my book, that we will succeed at not being threatened by what we're facing as a humanity and by others' differences.
At a time when people are divided, I mean, there's an election that's coming up, and I know, I just wonder, what do you think your role might be in helping to put forth what you're talking about, to help try to bring the country together in a really divisive time?
Well,
in past, you've been by the side of the Prime Minister, and now you have a very different life.
You know, I think that my focus, I'm not a politician, obviously. My focus will be on my work and how I can contribute. And it's always been clear to me that whether I was doing it, you know, on a volunteer basis through the co-political years or differently, my work stays the same and my movement from a place of integrity stays the same. So I can't wait to meet people on the path. And I know it's not easy, but I hope that this book and the message in it and the fact that people will feel safe enough to not only navigate its pages, but find tools to feel better. That's what I want to do.
Sophie Grégoire-Trudeau, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt. Be well.
Sophie Grégoire-Trudeau's new book is called Closer Together. It is out today.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.